Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for December 4th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, silencing a microRNA to treat hepatitis C, the combined effects of nitrogen and carbon dioxide on plant diversity, and an essay on the future of evolution. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how Americans are more wasteful than ever, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
According to the World Health Organization, hepatitis C may well be compared to a viral time bomb, with about 3% of the world's population infected, and 2% of the world's population chronic hepatitis C virus carriers, at risk of developing liver cirrhosis and/or liver cancer. Treatment options, according to the U.S. National Institutes of Health, include using alpha interferon, a host protein that is made in response to viral infections that has natural antiviral activity, as well as combinations or cocktails of interferons or pegylated interferons, along with other drugs. But all of these treatments have serious side effects and are only effective in about 50% of hepatitis C cases. And that's partly due to the many versions of the virus. So far, scientists have identified at least 6 major genotypes and more than 50 subtypes. Now, in a paper published online by Science, Henrik Orem and colleagues report a possible new antiviral therapy for hepatitis C, a compound called SPC-3649, that appears as if it will treat all forms of hepatitis C and not cause side effects. The compound silences a microRNA in liver cells that the virus uses to infect cells, and appears to be so central to how the virus functions that the virus did not appear to develop resistance to the treatment regimen. I spoke with Orem from his office at Santeris Pharma in Denmark. Santeris is a company focused on developing RNA therapeutics, and Orem is chief science officer and a vice president of the company.
First and foremost, the paper suggests that this novel drug candidate, SPC-3649, had the potential to eventually become an important new drug in the fight against HCV. And secondly, I would say that this paper adds to the growing body of evidence that our LNA drug platform has the potential to transform the field of RNA-targeted therapeutics, making specific and effective silencing of RNA targets involved in disease a reality in human medicine in the longer run.
What exactly does the drug do?
The drug binds to and inhibits microRNA 122, a liver-specific microRNA that HCV co-opts when it infects the hepatocytes, and which is required for HCV to replicate.
That's the hepatitis C virus, HCV.
Yes.
Okay. What else does microRNA 122 do in the body or in the liver?
In the normal liver cells, it regulates a host of messenger RNAs involved, amongst other things, in lipid and cholesterol biosynthesis. So when we inhibit this microRNA, we can see a drop in plasma cholesterol of about 30%, which becomes a biomarker for activity.
You say the cholesterol is lower. Was your team's aim in developing this drug therapy always to treat hepatitis C infections?
Yes, that was the objective from the very onset.
And these are tests in chimpanzees, is that right?
Yes, chimpanzees can get HCV in humans and are considered a very predictive model for how the drug will eventually do in human.
Okay. What treatment regimens, then, did you and your team try?
Well, we only had 4 animals available. This is a very exotic animal model, and we had to make do with 4 chimpanzees. So we used a very simple treatment schedule with once-weekly IV injections for 12 weeks, starting out with 2 placebo injections to establish the baseline in each of the 4 animals. We used 2 different doses. We investigated 1 milligram per kilo per week and a 5 milligram per kilo per week. And in the 5 milligram per kilo dose group, we saw a steady reduction in the HCV titer over the 12 weeks of dosing that was sustained several months after the last dose. In the 1 milligram per kilo, we also saw an effect, in particular in 1 animal, that was lower than the 5 milligrams, so showing a dose-dependent reduction in HCV titer.
So how effective then was this drug in, I guess, not curing, but treating the different animals as models for human hepatitis C?
Yeah, the drug has a very unique combination of a good potency, which translates into about a 2.5 log reduction in the high dose group, both of the 5 milligram per kilo animals. And it also was very well tolerated in these studies. And then it combines those potency and well tolerance with a unique barrier to resistance generation. So during the 12 week of treatment and in the 2 to 3 months post-dose where the virus remained suppressed, there was no evidence of viral escape whatsoever. And that's obviously a very unique feature of this drug, that it makes it unique amongst the many HCV candidates that are directly targeting the virus and which is under development these days.
Now, you said after 2 to 3 months, the treatment was still effective. What happened after that point?
Well, eventually the drug is metabolized and cleared from the body. And when the body clears the drug about 2 months after the last dose in the two high dose animals, the virus came back over time. But when we sequenced that population of reappearing viruses as compared to sequences of virus populations during and before treatment and in the follow-up period, there was no evidence of mutant viruses that were resistant to the treatment.
So the virus wasn't able to overcome or evolve to overcome the therapy?
It appears to be the case, yes. And that obviously compares to the STAT-C direct-acting viral inhibitors that are in late-stage clinical trials against HCV these days, and which have shown a very good potency, but which also suffers as direct-acting drugs from the virus' ability to mutate away from the drug. So viral rebound often occurs even within the treatment period with these drugs.
And the function then of the liver cells returned to near normal during treatment, and then after treatment stopped, hepatitis C returned once the drug was metabolized, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is potentially an ongoing treatment option.
We think it's going to be a treatment that combines with other treatments. That's probably the way forward with HCV as it has been with HIV. I think that's the consensus in the field, that there will be a cocktail of drugs. That cocktail would ideally involve some of the new STAT-C potent drugs, but would also involve a compound with a better mutation-resistant profile than those drugs would have individually. Currently, that would be interferon. We think that our drug, if all pans out and continues to progress well, could become a replacement for interferon in a cocktail with some of the STAT-C drugs that are being developed.
Where are you in clinical trials?
We've completed a single ascending dose in healthy volunteers, are pleased with the outcome. Those data will be reported probably in the first half of 2010. And we have commenced a multiple ascending dose also in healthy volunteers to be able to understand dose and dosing regime for a study in patients that may be started in 2010, depending obviously on results.
In terms of looking for side effects, what measurements were you and your team taking?
Well, we've done all the hematological and all the clinical chemistry and all the histopath that we can possibly do to make sure that we understand the safety of this drug maximally. We've done that in chimps. We've conducted IND-enabling tox studies in monkeys and mice, also with the whole gamut of tox and PK parameters, pharmacokinetic measurements on drug clearance and in systemic.
Are cholesterol levels of concern? Lowering cholesterol by 30% in an animal seems like it would be quite an impact.
Well, two things. That would be the amount of cholesterol lowering that the statins would produce, probably at the low end of what statins would produce, and that's a chronic treatment for a great number of people around the world. And secondly, this is not intended to be a chronic treatment. This is intended to be probably a 24 or 48 months treatment in a cocktail with other HCV agents. And once the drug is cleared at the end of that treatment, cholesterol is obviously going to return to normal levels. We also believe that this treatment will be subtype independent. The binding site for microRNA 122 on the HCV genome is fully conserved throughout all HCV subtypes. suggesting that all HCV variants, independent on subtypes, will be addicted to microRNA 122 for replication. So that's obviously a significant advantage of this drug candidate. I'd also like to stress another finding in the paper, namely that treatment of these chimpanzees actually reset a number of interferon-responding genes in the chimps that were deregulated at the onset of treatment. Chimpanzees actually are considered the equivalent of null responders in the human population. There is a subset of HCV carriers amongst humans that present with a elevated level of interferon-sensitive genes, and they are not responding to interferon treatment. Monkeys have the same phenotype. The chimps have the same phenotype of having elevated interferon-sensitive genes. So what we observed there was that those genes were normalized to normal levels during treatment with SPC-3649, suggesting that this drug could eventually also be used to resensitize human null responders to the standard of care. So that's another potential benefit of the drug.
Now, you said that this drug targets microRNA 122 and that all, you think, hepatitis C viruses are addicted, as you put it, to the use of microRNA 122 in order to replicate in the body. What about the genotypes of people that it will work for everybody?
We don't know that at this point in time. Obviously, as we progress with clinical trials, we will understand more about whether there's genetic diversity in the human population for this target. It does appear to be a target that is heavily locked in evolution. It's the exact same sequence from mice to man. And if it drifts, it will have to co-drift with the messenger RNA that it regulates. So it's probably an unlikely event that there will be sequence variations in microRNA 122 in the human population, but we'll just have to wait and see for future clinical trials.
Henrik Orem, thank you very much.
Well, thanks a lot.
Henrik Orem of Santaris Pharma is senior author of a paper on the therapeutic silencing of a microRNA to treat hepatitis C. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. In a scandal of stolen emails, ClimateGate, as it's being called, could have real implications for climate change discussions going on around the world. Here with more about it is Science's Policy Forum editor, Brad Weibel.
Computer hackers obtained and posted files from a server at the United Kingdom's University of East Anglia, including correspondence between prominent climate researchers. The emails contain discussions of data interpretation and presentation, as well as suggestions that researchers might blacklist certain climate skeptics. Some climate change skeptics are citing the emails as a smoking gun, which they say corrupts climate research findings. But others, including leading scientists and policymakers, are adamant that the illegally obtained emails have little bearing on the scientific consensus on climate change. Several investigations have been launched on both sides of the Atlantic in response. East Anglia officials are investigating the criminal breach of the release of the material. There are also investigations examining issues raised by the content of the emails, particularly related to suggestions to delete certain communications as a way to circumvent requests under the British version of the Freedom of Information Act. Senator James Inhofe, ranking Republican member of the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, sent letters to several scientists, as well as to the inspectors general of several federal agencies, notifying them to retain documents related to the release of emails. Representative Daryl Issa, ranking Republican member of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, said that he is also examining the issue. Pennsylvania State University has also announced it is looking into the content of email exchanges involving Penn State professor Michael Mann. Meanwhile, Phil Jones, the head of the University of East Anglia's Climate Research Unit, has temporarily resigned pending an internal review.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and increasing amounts of nitrogen pollution from industry and fertilizers on the ground would each alone seem like a good thing for plants. After all, plants require carbon dioxide to breathe, and nitrogen fertilizers are a mainstay of modern agriculture. But scientists know very little about the interactive effects of carbon dioxide and nitrogen on plant communities, particularly when it comes to the effects on plant species diversity. In a paper in this week's Science, Peter Reich reports the results from a 10-year experiment that's a part of the Biodiversity, CO2, and Nitrogen, or BioCon, project at the University of Minnesota. The results of the study show that the combined effects of nitrogen and carbon dioxide are not necessarily additive or even synergistic, as previous studies suggest, meaning that scientists cannot properly extrapolate from their studies to predict how ecosystems will respond to our altering global biogeochemical cycles. I spoke with Reich from his office at the University of Minnesota.
Despite concerns that rising carbon dioxide and nitrogen pollution levels together could lead to as much as a 50% loss in biodiversity, our 10-year field experiment shows that their joint effects are likely to be much, much smaller, something on the order of less than 10%. Although this is good news for biodiversity, these findings don't in any way lessen the need for strong policy action to curb CO2 emissions, given all the other ways CO2 is impacting the planet.
What's the effect of each of these substances, carbon dioxide and nitrogen, on plant diversity?
Well, we know a lot more about nitrogen effects on plant diversity than carbon dioxide effects. We know that high levels of nitrogen pollution or addition reduce diversity both from a large number of field-manipulated experiments and from studies of natural pollution gradients, particularly in Europe. The results from some of the European studies were that as much as 25% of diversity in Central Europe might be already lost to existing levels of nitrogen pollution on average, which is quite striking. And the way in which nitrogen or carbon dioxide could lead to reduced diversity is something sounds complicated called competitive exclusion, but it's actually pretty simple. Remember that both carbon and nitrogen are key nutrients that enable plants to grow. But what happens with competitive exclusion is that under rising CO2 or nitrogen pollution, species that are better adapted to these high resource levels are likely to become more abundant and more dominant and thus crowd out other species. And that's the mechanism people have identified for nitrogen. Now, with CO2, we actually might hypothesize the same thing because carbon dioxide also makes plants grow faster. But we don't have natural gradients that we can study because we've basically polluted the entire world with high CO2, and carbon dioxide mixes much more readily in the atmosphere. So we have basically the same levels of carbon dioxide everywhere for all practical purposes, whereas nitrogen pollution is more regional. So we can't find a carbon dioxide gradient to study this on. And it's quite difficult, again, much more difficult with carbon dioxide as a gas to do the experimental outdoor study of what it might be doing to vegetation.
And so you were trying to pin down how rising CO2 levels may alter species diversity in an environment where nitrogen is applied as fertilizer.
No. We were trying to understand how elevated levels of carbon dioxide on their own influence diversity and whether or not they suppress diversity, just like nitrogen pollution does. But we also were interested in whether or not the combination of rising CO2 and rising nitrogen pollution together have a double whammy effect and really reduce diversity, because we already know that nitrogen alone does reduce diversity.
So what was the setup of your experiment?
We use something called a free air CO2 enrichment technique, in which plants, quite a number of plots, 370 in total in six rings, are grown under either ambient or elevated CO2. So we're able to grow the plants outdoors without chambers, so they grow in natural soil conditions, natural rainfall and wind and insect conditions. But we can expose the enriched CO2 treatment plants to 560 parts per million. To the CO2 levels we will see on the planet somewhere between 2050 and 2090, depending on what we all do about our carbon emissions. And so we can basically test in this experiment how plants and ecosystems under today's carbon dioxide atmospheres will respond versus those under those later in the century. And so our experiment, the paper in Science, is drawn from a subset of this larger experiment with 370 plots. And for this experiment, I used 48 of the plots that were all planted with 16 perennial grassland species in 1997. And from 1998 until now, they've been exposed to either the ambient or enriched carbon dioxide levels and also ambient or elevated nitrogen levels. And in that case, we add nitrogen 4 grams nitrogen per meter squared per year, which is 40 kilograms hectare per year. For context, that's about the same level of pollution you'd get in a relatively polluted part of Europe or even Eastern North America. So it's more than we get in Minnesota, but it's still at the upper end of what we do see in industrialized regions in China and Europe in particular. And so we have basically these plots, each planted with 16 species that are now have been growing since 1998 at all combinations of ambient and elevated levels of either carbon dioxide or nitrogen. And we add nitrogen in a form called ammonium nitrate, but it's really stimulating the same kind of effect you get from nitrogen pollution. And that's been shown in many other studies to be a good surrogate for how nitrogen pollution acts on terrestrial ecosystem and on plants.
And so you report in your paper that elevated nitrogen reduced species diversity by 16% with the present levels of carbon dioxide, at least over the 10-year period, ambient, I guess.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
But with elevated carbon dioxide, diversity only decreased by 8%. Now, a previous study that you cite in your paper concludes that in some settings, climate and atmospheric changes are simply additive combinations of each effect by itself. Is this then just a different setting there in California and you're in Minnesota?
Well, that's a great question because a lot hinges on whether the study in California or the study in Minnesota is more representative of what happens generally. If the results of the California study are more representative, then we can take our knowledge of single global change factors studied one at a time and make models that predict what will happen when many things change at once and have some confidence that maybe those models will be okay. But if more often predictions that we might make from studying one factor at a time don't actually turn out to be accurate when you have multiple factors that can potentially cause interactions in the way plants interact with each other and with soil microbes and with other factors such as insects and the like, then we're going to have a much tougher time coming up with predictive models that will work for the rest of the world. Because interactions could be worse than or not as bad as mere additive effects. They don't necessarily have to be better than. And unfortunately, the governments that fund science around the world haven't seen fit to fund very many multiple factor experiments that look at the way in which global change factors such as climate change or elevated CO2 or nitrogen are influencing grasslands or forests or other kind of vegetation. So we actually only have a very small number of studies to try to extrapolate to the rest of the world from. And I might argue that a study of annual grassland in California and perennial grassland in Minnesota probably isn't a sufficient set of experiments to extrapolate about boreal forest across Siberia or the tropical forest in the Amazon, and that we actually need a few more studies to know when and whether these interactions are likely to occur or whether the effects are likely to be additive.
Peter Reich, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Peter Reich of the University of Minnesota on how elevated carbon dioxide mitigates plant diversity loss caused by nitrogen deposition. Find the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science.
The decisions we and our children make are going to have much more influence over the shape of evolution in the foreseeable future than physical events.
In Science's year-long series celebrating the year of Darwin, Carl Zimmer has our last installment, his essay on the future of evolution, titled The Origin of Tomorrow.
That's from Andrew Knoll, a paleontologist at Harvard University. And he said that when I asked him about his view of the future of evolution, and for him, really, we humans are the deciding factor, at least for as long as we humans are around.
In the past, what decisions have we made that have influenced the course of evolution?
Well, for one thing, we have domesticated animals and plants, and that has produced new kinds of organisms like dogs and corn and other crops and livestock. But then, you know, we've also made decisions about how we use the planet to raise those animals and plants. And so large areas of land have been cleared for farming and for raising livestock and so on. And that's led to a growing number of extinctions. At the same time, we have also been finding new ways of producing energy, and a lot of that involves burning up fossil fuel, which is leading to climate change, and that is already starting to have an effect on the evolution of life on Earth.
So more of the same for the future in terms of our impact on evolution? Domestication, habitat loss, extinctions, and climate change, or something else?
Well, we are sort of doing everything in an even more extreme way than we've done before. So, for example, now we aren't just artificially selecting plants and animals simply by picking out the individuals we want to breed. We're starting to identify individual genes that we want to pluck out of one species and stick in another. And so that is going to be creating new kinds of variation, new kinds of life forms. The question there is, how much are they going to actually affect the evolution of life as a whole? And, you know, in some cases, synthetic microbes that we might engineer to create new sources of energy, they might only be able to survive in a tank or in a flask in a lab somewhere. And so they're not really going to be an important part of the biosphere.
Why not?
Well, you know, they might be really good at spewing out gasoline or some other energy, but they may end up being really lousy at just living in the real world and competing with lots and lots and lots of other microbes that have been, you know, evolving for millions, billions of years even, to make a really good use of a particular ecological niche. So these might be just kind of like microbial lapdogs.
How about our own evolution then? How has our knowledge and our application of that knowledge, I guess our civilization, how is that thought to have altered our evolution?
Well, ironically, in some ways, it's speeded up our evolution, or at least it's created new kinds of selection pressures. So, for example, human civilization has created a lot of diseases, starting with malaria, for example, which probably got its start as a really intense human disease when we started clearing land for crops and you started to have ponds forming where mosquitoes could lay their eggs, and then there were farmers sleeping in huts nearby that were really good targets for those mosquitoes. And so once malaria became a really intense threat for humans, there was this opportunity for natural selection to produce adaptations for resistance to malaria. And so actually, in the human genome, you can find a number of different defenses against malaria in particular, and they've only evolved probably in the last several thousand years.
And how about the future for genetics, applying genetics to further speed up the evolution of people?
Well, there is certainly work that's been going on recently that suggests that we might be able to tinker with the human genome in the sense of being able to repair a faulty gene in a fetus, in an embryo, and so that it wouldn't be born with that defect. So it might be possible to go in and sort of monkey around, as it were, with the process of mutation and to affect how genes are being passed down from generation to generation. The problem there is that, again, if you do all the work involved just to modify the genes in one child, that's just one child. And there are millions upon millions of children born every year, and all those children have new mutations in them, natural mutations that arise. So, you know, over the course of generations, that engineered gene might just disappear, just maybe because somebody happens not to pass down that particular copy of a gene to their child, and after a while, that engineered gene just disappears. On the other hand, maybe there might be an engineered gene that might have kind of an economic drive behind it. So if evolution can't help it, maybe economics can. So one anthropologist was speculating with me about the possibility that there might be a gene to make people thin. And if it was cheap enough, then maybe a lot of people would really want to get that for their kids. And then all of a sudden that gene is spreading through a substantial fraction of the human population.
So economics, the drive to purchase traits, may overcome the ethical concerns in, as you say, monkeying around with the human genome even.
Yeah, I mean, obviously right now there are huge ethical issues about what's called germline engineering. And, you know, it might well not happen just because people just decide that that's wrong, that we shouldn't be doing things like that. But, you know, I don't know. I suspect that eventually people will. I mean, it'll start with cases where there are really severe genetic disorders that can be fixed. And, you know, I would imagine that some parents would say, you know, I would like to change that gene in my child so that my child doesn't have to suffer an incredibly painful, possibly lethal disease. And then, you know, then there'll be a debate about, well, where do you go from there? Which things are allowable and which aren't. And it's conceivable that eventually people will be doing this quite frequently. And if they do it frequently enough, then maybe this kind of engineering will change the human genome in a way that evolution has not yet.
Is there any evidence that Darwin might have seen some or perhaps even all of this coming?
I don't think that Darwin ever really saw genetic engineering coming because Darwin didn't really understand how genes work. But, you know, certainly he saw the power of humans over our own evolution and over the evolution of other things. But Darwin also, of course, was concerned about the power that humans had to cause extinctions, whether it was extinctions of other humans or extinctions of other species. And he saw that this could be a real concern. So there are definitely a lot of things that Darwin did recognize, most importantly, that evolution isn't over. Evolution is going to keep going as long as there's life on Earth.
Carl Zimmer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer writes on the future of evolution in this week's issue. You can find the whole series of Origins essays and a companion blog celebrating the year of Darwin at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Finally today, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how Americans are more wasteful than ever. In what ways, Dave?
Well, Rob, this is an appropriate story for our post-Thanksgiving week, our celebration of the harvest and consumptions of copious quantities of turkey and other foodstuffs. The study is all about how much of the food that is available to us as American consumers do we actually eat? And the bigger question is, how much food are we wasting on a yearly basis?
How is that statistic calculated?
Well, it's not easy. Before the study, what researchers would do would be that they would conduct interviews with consumers or even conduct garbage inspections to see how much food was being wasted. But as you can probably guess, that's pretty unreliable. You're dealing with people's opinions, and garbage inspections are very regional type metrics. So for this study, the researchers said, let's take the entire number of calories available to all Americans, and this is based on all of the food that's produced and imported into the U.S., and divide that by the number of Americans. That'll give us the number of calories that's available to the average American, and then subtract out the number of calories that are actually consumed. And the researchers can figure that out by figuring out over a certain amount of time period, how much collective weight have we all gained?
And they're excluding things like exports and canned goods or stockpiles of grain, things like that?
Exactly. They're really just trying to deal with the food we have available to ourselves that we could conceivably eat on a daily basis.
So what are the figures?
Well, here's one data point from 2003. In that year, researchers found that the average American had about 3,700 calories available to them, but they only consumed about 2,300 of these calories, leaving over 1,400 calories wasted. And that comprised about waste of 39% of the food supply. And this is a trend that's actually been growing more dramatic over the years. The researchers looked at the years from 1974 to 2003. And in 1974, researchers found that Americans were only wasting about 30% of the food that was available, calculated in the same way, versus about 40% today. So that's a pretty dramatic rise over the past few decades.
Where's the extra loss happening? Restaurants, table clearing, things like that? People eating out more?
Well, the researchers say they don't have an answer for that, Rob, but according to another study, about 60% of American food waste happens at home. So what this is saying is there's a lot of food that we buy that we're just not using or we're throwing out.
Is there some underlying reason that's driving this increase in waste? Do researchers have any speculation about what that might be?
Well, the researchers say that in relative terms, food is actually pretty cheap these days and cheaper than it has been in the past. And when food is cheaper, people tend to feel like they can waste more of it. Whereas if food was very expensive, people would want to get the most for their money and potentially eat every last bean out of that can or every last piece of that Thanksgiving turkey.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from finding out where all of America's food waste has gone to pandas finding each other in the wild, this next story is about how a female panda's call attracts a male suitor. And here's what that call sounds like. Now, that may not sound like the most charming noise to you and me, Rob, but for a male panda, that is music to their ears. Female pandas only go into heat about once a year, and when they do, they make these chirping noises. Now, they usually make these chirping noises anyways. In fact, pandas make various grunts and other types of noises in the wild to find each other, and female pandas chirp. But what the researchers found in this study is that the tone of this chirp, the way it sounds, changes when the females are most fertile. And they think that's a signal to males that says, hey, I'm ready to mate.
Is this the first time that scientists have found an animal that changes the tone of its chirping or other sounds to attract males at the time of estrus or heat?
Actually, Rob, scientists have also found that women, human women, do a very similar thing.
I must not be listening very carefully.
You're not, because according to other studies, women's voices become more high-pitched during the most fertile periods of their hormonal cycles. But what's interesting about this study is that's never been seen before in animals outside of humans. So this is the first study showing a non-human female can change the way it talks, for all intents and purposes, during its most fertile times.
I imagine this will help in conservation efforts. Pandas are endangered, aren't they?
They are, and that's an important point. The researchers say that maybe by playing these chirps for males, it might help better get them in a mood when they're trying to mate pandas in captivity.
Is it just the production of the sound, or is it the sound directed towards a particular male panda?
Well, it's possible that females have a particular male in mind. In the wild, researchers have shown that females seem to direct their chirps at a particular male while they growl to keep other males away. And so, you know, conservationists will have to take that into account to make sure that the male they're arousing is actually the male that the female wants.
Okay, so last story this week. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from the forest of pandas to the underwater forest of corals, this last story is about how corals and the organisms that live on them deal with the intense sunlight that they experience underwater.
I thought the water sort of acted as a filter to that sunlight.
Well, actually, Rob, living on a coral reef is a lot like living on a tanning bed. You're getting sunlight coming from above, and that's actually being magnified a lot by the ocean water. And the sunlight can potentially bounce off the coral skeletons, which can be very bright, and bounce back up onto the organisms that are living on these coral reefs. And so you're getting sort of hit from all directions, as it were. That's a lot of UV radiation, potentially. And UV is bad because it can damage tissue, it can damage DNA.
So how do the animals cope?
Well, Rob, it turns out that these coral exoskeletons, which are made of calcium carbonate, and they're made by a lot of the organisms that actually live on coral reef, not only corals themselves, but anemones and other organisms deposit these calcium carbonate structures, which make up sort of what we associate with what a coral reef looks like. It turns out, researchers knew before this study, that if you shine UV light on these coral exoskeletons, that they fluoresce, which indicates that they're absorbing this UV light and emitting it with a different wavelength. And the researchers said, if the coral skeletons are doing this, maybe they are actually absorbing a lot of these UV rays and preventing them from bouncing off of them and hitting a lot of the organisms that live on the coral. And so to test this, they took a sea anemone, which is a coral relative, and it also has a lot of organisms living on it, like coral does. And they put it both on coral exoskeletons, and they put it on just white plumbing tape. And what they found is that when the organisms were put on the coral exoskeletons, they experienced 4 times less UV radiation and 7 times less DNA damage than the organisms that were put on the white plumbing tape. So this really indicated that coral does have this function. It absorbs UV light and it sort of acts as a sunscreen protecting the organisms that live on it.
So what's providing the protection? What's absorbing UV radiation and emitting something else?
Well, Rob, one theory that researchers had was it was something about the shape of the coral exoskeleton. Maybe the roughness of it was somehow bouncing these UV rays in different directions that was somehow protecting the organisms. But what they found is they actually crushed the skeleton up, so it was just this fine powder. And even when it was this powder, it had the same protective effects, indicating that there's something chemically about the coral exoskeleton that absorbs UV light and prevents it from striking some of the creatures that live on the coral.
Does this suggest that other animals that fluoresce are perhaps doing this same kind of thing? What else fluoresces under sunlight?
Well, Rob, researchers know that some scorpions and spiders also fluoresce when they're hit with UV light. So it's possible that these creatures also have found a way to protect themselves by absorbing UV light in the same way.
So researchers don't know then exactly what chemicals are at play here.
Well, Rob, the chemistry could be different in these different animals. These organisms are obviously not very highly related to each other, so it's possible that this ability, this UV protectant ability, has evolved more than once.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how feeding the birds might change their evolutionary fate. And another story about how mice without fathers live longer. And for Science Insider, the Science Policy blog, we've been closely following what some are calling ClimateGate. And this is the release of thousands of private emails between high-ranking climate scientists and the impact that these emails are having on the debate about climate legislation, both in Washington and around the world. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the Science Policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the December 4th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.